I'm Dick Gordon. Coming up, the story of tracing the root of the slave trade, only this time it's not the descendants of slaves. Instead, it's people whose ancestors were the slave traders. When Katrina Brown uncovers disturbing proof that her forebears were among America's most successful and most ruthless slave trading families, she gathers up a number of other descendants and they head off to Africa, witnesses to this ancestral horror. They didn't think it would be easy, and they were right.
There was a moment at one of the slave forts where my cousin Dane approached an African-American woman in order to invite her to the dialogue that we were having, and he extended his hand to introduce himself to her, and she refused to shake his hand and said, "I was hoping not to see any white people here."
Facing shame in the shadow of the family tree, I'll talk with Katrina about her return to the places where her own ancestors enslaved thousands. PBS is airing a new series of its show, African American Lives. The Harvard professor, Henry Louis Gates Jr., uncovers the history of well-known Americans using old records and DNA. Along with people like the comedian Chris Rock, Professor Gates goes back into the ancestral history of those whose American experience began in chains.
Your great-great-grandfather, Julius Caesar Tingman, served in the U.S. colored troops during the Civil War. He enrolled on March 7th.
I'm going to cry. I can't believe it.
After 21 years living as a slave, he risked his life by joining the Union soldiers.
I never knew he knew this.
Wow.
This is great.
Today on the story, genealogy from the other side. Katrina Brown discovers that her family was one of the largest slave trading families in New England.
It was as if I was a slave trader. I mean, that was sort of the emotional tenor of it for me early on, was as if I was the guilty one.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
Katrina Brown grew up in Philadelphia, just a few blocks from the Liberty Bell. But every 4th of July, her family went back to Bristol, Rhode Island, where her prominent ancestors, the DeWolf family, had lived. She would watch the parade from the manicured lawn of a family mansion.
My DeWolf ancestors were known as the Great Folk in Bristol. There were professors and writers, artists and architects, and many Episcopal ministers. I was proud to be related to them. I was also drawn to this fairy tale world of old New England. These images of my grandparents when they were young. It never occurred to me to ask how we got so established.
That question wound up being the subject of a film we'll talk about a bit later. Katrina says it really started for her when she got a small booklet about family history that her grandmother had written.
She was clearly thinking about the fact that her grandchildren probably didn't know that much about their family history and probably didn't care that much. And so it was her attempt to write down some things that she thought would be important for her grandchildren to know. And it was a dozen pages or so, mostly happy stories and proud tales and reminiscence from her childhood, but also a sort of sweep of the family history. And she put in two sentences about the slave trade, which she could easily have skipped over completely, but she put a couple sentences
in. What did
she
say?
She said, "I haven't the stomach to describe the ensuing slave trade. Suffice it to say that the whole town was involved." And my reaction when I read that, the very first reaction was, "I can't believe it," as if this was news. And then within seconds, realizing that I already knew.
That you already knew what? That the family fortune was built on slave trading?
Yeah. If someone had sat me down and said, "Katrina, we have something to tell you. You're descended from the largest slave trading family in U.S. history," I presume I would remember that. It would be a seminal moment.
Right. And you're not to tell anybody.
Right. Right. So there wasn't clearly a moment like that, but I think it was part of what my mom and my aunts and uncles had in their consciousness, and they knew about it. But there was a way in which they were thought of as pirates and kind of scallywags. And so this combination of tisk tisk with the finger about them and a kind of romanticization as if, oh, you know, those glamorous seafaring days. So I think that was part of the culture of the family. So I just wouldn't be surprised if it was the kind of thing that was mentioned in passing. Because it's the funniest thing, because I had that moment literally with the booklet in my hands of my grandmother being shocked because it was so horrific to realize I was descended from slave traders. And then instantly knowing I already knew, I subsequently talked to a college roommate. And she said, "Katrina, you talked about that in college." And I said, "What? I have no memory of talking about it in college." And she said, no, I remember you telling me that. And literally, I have no recollection of it.
At the time, Katrina Brown was studying in seminary. When she faced this, she wasn't sure what she was going to do next.
As it happened, there was on campus shortly after, there was a Day of the Dead ceremony where people were invited to do altars to their ancestors. So that forced a few issues for me. What would I do if I was trying to do an altar to deal with this?
Because that's an honor of the ancestors, right? And you're thinking, do I want to honor these guys?
Right, which obviously I didn't, but it arrived as a real invitation to start to try to make sense of it. And scholarship was just being done on the North's amnesia about slavery. So a book came out, how the North conveniently forgot about its role in slavery and the slave trade. So the fact that I saw my own personal amnesia and how I had managed to bury a very painful and uncomfortable truth, that was also, you know, writ large in our family, but then to see that it was also writ large in New England as a whole was a real revelation.
I know you spent a lot of time in research after that. Take me to a moment when you actually got your hands on documents, when you thought to yourself, I can't even believe people wrote this down. How bad were these guys?
Well, it's one thing to learn this from your grandmother in a desktop published little booklet. It's another thing to go into a bookstore, get a book off the shelf called The Slave Trade, and go to the index and find DeWolf in the index. And that was one of those shocking moments where I was like, you know, maybe I'd been hoping it was all just made up after all. but there they were in ink in a bookstore in a book. And then the even bigger shock, and this was a discovery that I made that I haven't had anyone in the family say that they already knew this, because basically because we weren't really thinking about it, talking about it, no one had gone and looked up the scholarly research. So I did get my hands on a book by Jay Cautry. And he's the one person who's done a really quantitative analysis of the slave trade in Rhode Island. So I went, looked up DeWolf in the index, went to those pages, and there it was. It said, without a doubt, the DeWolfs had the largest share in the American slave trade of any family before or after the Revolution. So that was big news.
Just, all of a sudden, you're not a family that's sort of tripping along with what's faddish at the time, but you're...
the worst of the worst. Yeah.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Katrina Brown went further. She went in search of local archives.
On my first visit to the Bristol Historical Society, they said, there's a file cabinet upstairs. Go ahead and take a look. So here's this file cabinet in the corner, and I start opening the drawers, and oh my God, there were just hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pieces of paper, receipts, canceled checks, letters, I mean, just all this business correspondence and just all this evidence. And it had this eerie, you know, I'd studied the Holocaust in college and studied sort of the meticulousness with which the Nazis kept records. And it just had that feeling of like, oh my God, it's all right here. And they were, for whatever reason, a lot of those records got saved.
Was the language of the receipts and the bills in any way disguised to make it look honorable? Or did they say outright, bought three men, four women, paid this, that sort of thing?
Yeah, it's very matter of fact. So bought 9 prime slaves, 1 boy, 9 girls, you know, just very straightforward. So some of the logs of when the ship captains would go to the west coast of Africa, they would actually go up and down the coast visiting different forts and purchasing people, sort of logs sort of day after day about the weather and how many people were bought and sold and in exchange for what. You know, one particularly dreadful one was about buying women slaves in exchange for handkerchiefs, which, what can you say to that? So
what were you thinking as you went through all this?
When I first discovered it, I found it really hard to talk to anyone about it. I had so much shame, and in a funny way, it was, this may sound totally irrational, but it was as if I was a slave trader. I mean, that was sort of the emotional tenor of it for me early on, was as if I was the guilty one. And where the more I dug into it, the more I could actually, you know, it's another interesting result of holding the stuff in your hands. Then you start to say, well, it's not me, actually. I was not the slave trader. I did not go to West Africa. So there's this funny thing that happens where the thing that I was so mortified, horrified, guilt-ridden, just overwhelmed with, the more I got into it, the more that guilt went away, because the more kind of rational I could get about it and understand it and learn how it worked and what happened. So the horror of it is still there.
Was it a kind of a scholarly detachment that you became more of a student of it, less someone who was just being shocked by it?
Hmm. The more I thought it was me in a funny way, the more I had that just overarching feeling of guilt. Then that creates a kind of defensiveness. So the sort of more defensive I then felt with African Americans, period, the more I got into it and could kind of say, you know, objectively separate myself from it, the more then I could feel empathy for African Americans. So I wouldn't say my feelings went away, they just shifted. So
it's interesting to listen to you struggle to describe that, because in many ways what you're describing are exactly those conflicting feelings that so many white Americans have about reparations. It's my fault, it's not my fault, I should feel shame, I should, you know what I mean?
You've
heard this, you've lived this now for a long, long time. But at some point, though, Katrina, you thought to gather a group of family people together, you thought about making a film. What was going on in your mind? Where did those ideas come from?
Well, if it were just a matter of me needing therapy, basically around my ancestry, I would have gone to therapy. but it felt like there was a much larger story there, because it unlocked this whole piece about New England self-righteousness, white New England self-righteousness, this whole...
The way that you illustrate that is by gathering together a group of DeWolf descendants.
White, self-righteous New Englanders.
I didn't say that.
How can we ask for forgiveness from black people?
I'm not asking for forgiveness today. I'm saying down the road.
We can't have any expectations.
I don't hear anyone saying that they expect forgiveness. Certainly not.
But we do have somebody saying that if we don't get it, it's not going to work, which is the same
Dane's
damn
saying,
thing.
No, Dane's saying eventually.
What we're listening to is a scene from a film that Katrina Brown made when she gathered DeWolf family descendants together for a trip they would make to the slave coast of Ghana and to the former slave plantations of Cuba. I'll talk with her more about that trip and what it was actually like to retrace the roots of slave trading ancestors. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. When descendants of the DeWolf family were children, they knew of a family nursery rhyme that went like this.
Adjoy and Polydor sitting in the cellar door. Polydor and Adjoy sitting in the cellar way. Down fell the cellar door. Bump went Polydor. Up flew the cellar way. Off flew Adjoy.
Katrina Brown knew that rhyme. But it wasn't until her own research into her family history was well underway that she also learned that Adjoye and Polydor were two child slaves who'd been given by James DeWolf to his wife Anne as a Christmas gift in 1802. And that later, when it was suggested by some abolitionists that Adjoye and Polydor could be set free, the family had refused. But Katrina was learning by this point just how big the DeWolf family slave trade operation had been. From 1769 and for another 50 years, the DeWolfs transported thousands of men and women and children to the U.S. and Cuba. Katrina decided that the best way to confront this history was to go back to Africa with other family members and to make a film of the journey. She wrote dozens of letters and wound up with 9 other volunteers. DeWolf descendants from across the U.S., men and women ranging in age from their 30s to their 70s.
So when I talked to them, part of what I said was, You have to be willing to make a fool of yourself on camera and potentially in front of all America. So don't sign up if you don't want to get into the mess of this, because a lot of what happens for us, I think, as white people is we're just scared of saying the wrong thing and being perceived as racist and putting our foot in our mouths and all that. So the sort of contract I had with people was only do this if you're willing to suffer that kind of embarrassment.
Talk to me about arriving in Ghana. The time that you spend in Ghana was either going to make this work or it wasn't. You gather this film crew together.
Two film crews.
Yeah. Relatives off to Ghana. And yet you don't really know what's going to happen, do you?
Right.
And were you nervous as a descendant of the DeWolfs, or were you nervous as a filmmaker here?
Both. Definitely my experience was colored by my responsibilities as a filmmaker as well as by actually being a descendant. So for me, it was, I think, doubly intense. So, we were going at a very loaded time, which was a risk. There was an event taking place when we were there called PanaFest, which is the Pan-African Historical Theater Festival. And it's an event that's organized by Ghanaians and also by African-American expatriates who live in Ghana. And it's an invitation to people of African descent from the diaspora to come to Ghana as a kind of homecoming pilgrimage. So people come, a lot of African-Americans come to visit the slave forts for the first time, to come back home, as it were, for the first time. So it's an incredibly intense pilgrimage for them. And I and my colleagues decided to risk going at the same time as that, knowing that it was loaded to do that, and that we had long talks about which events was it, did we think it was okay to go to. You know,
we shouldn't go there because we have a camera. We shouldn't go there because we're white. We shouldn't go there because we're the descendants of slave traders.
Yeah, all of the above. And we had two camera crews. We purposefully had a white American camera crew, and then we hired a Ghanaian crew as well. So we literally would decide, okay, which crew is going to this event, and are the family going to go? So sometimes the Ghanaian crew would go to an event without any family members so that we wouldn't have a disruptive presence for people. And other times we went, and it led to a lot of arguments, and it's just highly charged.
You were confronted at one point by a couple of small Ghanaian schoolgirls.
Yes.
Tell me about that.
We had the idea to invite people that we met to come join us for a dialogue. And one of the people who took us up on that was actually a school teacher who decided to invite these schoolgirls to come. And so they came along with a lot of adults, both Ghanaians and African Americans. And the schoolgirls were, it was so striking. It was actually a conversation that they had with my cousin. So here's this elderly man in his early 70s and these 10, 11, 12-year-old girls. And they just put it right to him. And
your ancestors, did they bought our people with a lot of money?
I'm sorry, I didn't catch it.
I said, did your ancestors bought our ancestors with a lot of money?
In the olden days.
Did they buy them with a lot of money? No.
The white people, they lied to us that they are coming to make friends with us and trade with us. Instead of that, what they said, they came and make us slaves. Are you not ashamed of coming here?
What? Am I not ashamed?
Yeah,
I am ashamed. Yeah. It's a shame. It is a shaming thing.
And they were just so blunt and direct. They just said, are you not ashamed of coming here? Happily, Ledley is a man for such a moment. So he was just very engaged with them, and it was just a powerful moment.
Were there times when you thought you shouldn't be there?
Absolutely. There were specific events where some family members felt that it was okay to go, and I thought it wasn't, and I didn't go, so we made different choices at different times. There was a moment at one of the slave forts where my cousin Dane approached an African-American woman in order to invite her to the dialogue that we were having, and he extended his hand to introduce himself to her, and she refused to shake his hand and said, I was hoping not to see any white people here. And that just said it all. Sort of, this is this incredibly sacred moment for an African-American person to be coming back to the slave forts, and the last thing they want to deal with or have to confront is the presence of a white American, particularly us.
And how about you? I mean, was there a moment when you felt that it was a mistake, that you'd kind of in some way come back to the scene of the crime?
I never thought it was a mistake to come back. I did have questions in my mind about whether that was the right time to do it during that festival. And I should say there were other people who had the opposite reaction, which was it meant so much to them that we were there. So people who came to the dialogue and people who we met who would say, oh my God, I can't believe that you're willing to face this and that you're willing to come here and that you're willing to show up, basically. So we got the full range of reactions, which is understandable. So
you came across something else in Ghana, and that was whatever it is that links your church, the Episcopal Church, and the slave trade, which came as, I think, something of a surprise to see what that link was. What did you see?
At one of the slave forts, there was a church that was built right over the dungeons, and that was a Portuguese church. There was certainly a period where the thought was, these are the heathens who were going to civilize them, so we're doing them a favor by enslaving them and bringing them to the New World, and part of the favor that we're doing for them is we're going to baptize them and make them Christian to save their souls.
So the churches were not there to give some kind of absolution to the white slave traders, but they were there actually to be a part of the exercise in converting the people in chains before they headed off to America.
I think a little bit of both, and it wasn't, you know, a sort of consistent policy throughout the hundreds of years of the slave trade, sometimes a process of baptizing and converting and sometimes ministering to the people who were there.
But kind of creepy nonetheless to see the cross
yes.
over these slave forts, right?
Yeah, exactly.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. As Katrina Brown was facing the fact that she's the descendant of a notorious slave-trading family, she gathered together a group of other descendants for a trip to the slave coast of Ghana. At one point, she says, they went inside the dungeons to do some filming, and something unexpected happened.
The battery on the camera light died, so we were suddenly in pitch darkness.
And you're in a room with no windows at this point, right?
One tiny, tiny, tiny window way up high. So basically the dungeons are obviously below ground, and this particular room had a tiny window, the equivalent of two or three stories up.
And how big was the space that you were in?
Not big. Twice as big as an average living room, I would say.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. And it was what, the room that you were in?
It was part of, I believe, the male dungeon. So it would have been hundreds of men were crammed in there, and this was where they were held to wait for the slave ships that were coasting up and down the coast. And so people from all different tribes, not all speaking the same language, in complete terror, not knowing their fate, not being taken care of in any kind of way, you know, in terms of just basics. So just a horrific, horrific, horrific place.
No, I've heard the stories of you know, that this ground is blood and bodily fluids and skin, and that's, you know, generations of that.
Yeah.
And you're aware of that when you're in there.
Yeah.
So here you are, a handful of the descendants of the slave traders. Mm-hmm. You're in there.
We're standing on this ground.
And the camera light goes out and you're in darkness.
Yeah. So the camera person immediately said, I'll go get the battery for the light in the van outside. And she starts to leave to go do that. Everyone starts heading for the door to get out of there. It struck me that maybe we should stay. So I basically said into the darkness, you know, what about staying? Why don't we stay and just wait? So we did. And honestly, I think probably every single one of us could say it was the longest 10 minutes of our lives. No question. No words. We sat in quiet. And so the imagination kicks in a more profound way when you're in that circumstance.
What were you thinking?
My chest constricted. My heart started pounding. I had my own very personal physical reaction to being in the dark in a confined space, knowing where I was. And it all just kind of came together to just create this intense physical panic kind of reaction.
Where'd your imagination go, though?
That the circumstances that I was in at that moment were so trivial, minor, inconsequential, and yet created such an intense emotional panic and fear. So definitely a key moment in deepening my ability to empathize, because it's hard for the imagination to go to hard places. So it wasn't the only, but it was one of the most intense moments that kind of triggered a change of heart towards, you know, there's a funny, I don't think I've ever quite named this before, but I think there's almost a taboo around a white person saying they can imagine what it was like to be African-American or to be at that moment an African person enslaved and chained. I feel like there's almost a sort of, you'll never know what it was like. You can't possibly imagine. So there's a funny dynamic where maybe I hadn't fully given myself permission to try to empathize. And that moment sort of crossed a threshold into, I'm a human, I'm imagining the horror of it. And that shift, I think, is really important, because then it also creates a lot more empathy for Black rage today. I mean, I think one of the legacies of slavery is there's a whole lot of rage that for centuries, to express that rage was to risk your life. So it didn't have anywhere to go if one was trying to survive. You know, we can sit here today and say, why should I have to listen to Black rage? I didn't do it, and that was a long time ago. But I kind of think of it as this energy that hasn't had a safe outlet, and that now I have just, my spirit is able to welcome that anger, and I actually don't take it personally anymore because I get that I wasn't the slave trader. I actually have a lot more room to receive that anger and honor it.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. The film that was made of Katrina Brown's family journey to the Slave Coast is called Traces of the Trade. Katrina and the others are white American descendants of a slave trading family. One of the co-producers of the film is a woman named Juanita Capri Brown. She's no relation. In fact, she's African American, and it had been decided that her role would be very much behind the camera. But at one point during the filming, when the whole white-black mess gets tense and confusing, Juanita is asked to sit in front of the camera and talk about her feelings.
Of course I'm angry at white people, you know? I think white people have been cowards and have chosen to give up their integrity and their humanity for so long, knowing what's happened to my people. Like, it's ridiculous. If you grew up where I grew up, you'd be pissed off, you know? Anybody who's alive, you know, or who's paying attention should be pissed off. You know, and the fact that white people are not pissed off means that they're not paying attention.
Did it change the dynamic to have Juanita just unload like that?
It was definitely a crucial moment, and the discussion that we were having that afternoon was just heated all over the place. So that conversation with Ellie then triggered Tom to have a conversation with Juanita about, you know, he thought that she liked us, and it was this classic situation where we were all getting to know each other, and there was, you know, there was a lot of love there, but there was also, you know, for African Americans, there's this double life where you see the humanity of people. You know, we weren't a group of people who were so horrible, and she, of course, had feelings of care for us, and she holds on to that anger and that sense that, as she said, that white people have been in denial. And so when Tom saw that and heard that, he then got confused about, but I thought we were friends. So it's a really important conversation.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. My guest is the filmmaker, Katrina Brown. It was a risky venture on her part to take a number of descendants of her own slave trading family, people she'd just met, and ask them to retrace, together, the routes the slaves were taken on. At one point, while the cameras were rolling, one of the women on the trip shows her frustration.
I'm having a real problem with, I don't know what to call it, the itinerary. It just feels way out of balance to me. How it's feeling right now is that it's going to show up as a really neat travelogue about slavery. But damn, I need to have us connect more between each other on a feeling level. A lot is going on between us, and we're just being our nice Protestant selves, and I'm sick of it.
There was a lot of up and down, and almost all of us grew up in a similar family culture, which was one where you don't talk about your feelings and you don't talk about uncomfortable subjects. And so there's this kind of button down nature, and most of us would share that sentiment. So
talk to me about the process of leading this group, though, Katrina. Were there times when you thought, this is just a travel trip on slavery? We're not getting anything done. We're going to come across on camera as a group of upper-class white people, you know, wandering around through the slave forts and the forests of Cuba as if we're somehow, by being here, making whatever our ancestors did right.
Right. Yeah. That was an absolute fear. And we went in and out of being able to face the intensity of what we were dealing with. So we're human. So there were times in Cuba where I was like, can we just go dancing? You know, so we were aware, on the one hand, I could be judgmental about us. Like, yeah, we were just on a fancy trip, one could say, but we clearly weren't. We were clearly doing this in order to really tackle hard stuff. And we were human and needed a break from that. And it's a privilege that white people have to choose when to face this stuff and when not to. So if you're Black in America, you don't always get to choose when to face this and when not to.
Katrina Brown and the other descendants of her slave trading family were recording their own travels on film. It's now in the process of being released, and it's called Traces of the Trade. In just a moment, I'll talk with Katrina not about what she saw and what she filmed, but what she learned. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Katrina Brown is one of the direct descendants of an American slave trading family, the DeWolfs. She made a film about her and nine other members of the DeWolf family retracing a major slave trade route from Ghana to Cuba and back to the family estate in Bristol, Rhode Island. It often put her group in an awkward position. That's because many African Americans, the descendants of the slaves, also travel that same route. At one point, a handful of the DeWolf descendants found themselves at a river at a healing ritual. Now think about this. The descendants of slave owners watching the descendants of slaves in an act of spiritual healing.
The goddess of this river carried downstream all of our sorrows, all of our pain, all of our madness, all those insanities we collected during that period of time.
My cousin Dane approached the elder because he wanted to see if he'd perform the ceremony for him for a healing, and the man said, you should ask your own elders to play that role, and basically said, go home and go home and figure out your own rituals. This one isn't for you. And that was seminal for Dane and for all of us as we debriefed it with him and posed for us this really important question, which is, what would our healing ritual look like? And where should we be turning for that? Because there is a temptation to go to African Americans for probably, in a sense, for forgiveness and for that magic that maybe gets associated with kind of shaman and whatnot, that typically whites want to go get that elsewhere. And we don't know how to look back within our own culture to say, what can we do? What are our traditions that might be brought to bear on this?
Katrina Brown returned to the Episcopal Church, where she and others pressed church leaders for a promise to examine the role of the church in the slave trade, and they got that assurance. Katrina's film, Traces of the Trade, was recently screened at the Sundance Film Festival, and one of the others on the trip wrote a book about his experience. But I wanted to know from Katrina how the trip changed her. Her sense of her own place and her own responsibility in American history.
If you had said the word reparations to me 10 years ago, I would have gone into a panic. I would have, all my walls would have come up and I would have gotten really flustered and I wouldn't have been able to think and I wouldn't have all my rational.
Well, you could intellectualize it. You could say, well, on this hand and yes, on this hand. I mean, you were
a student. Oh, no, I couldn't. No, it was so charged that I couldn't, all my rational capacities would be out the door because it was so loaded. So that kind of just shut down, can't think anymore, scared. And I was like, what am I doing? I shouldn't be going public with our family history at a time like this. So I've evolved to a place of like, oh my God, I can talk about it. It's complex. It's something that we, you know, intelligent people can disagree about reparations, but it's important to be committed to have the conversation. What does reparations mean? There's so many different ways of thinking about it. Can't we all agree that there's repair needed? And then sorting through all those stories and emotions that get in the way of doing that is what I've been able to do. And I'm so much happier for that and feel like I can look Black people in the eye now in a way that I couldn't before. And that doesn't mean that there's not still have a distance to go and that I don't have many hard moments that lead me to kind of despair. But at a just really fundamental level, I feel like, okay, I can look you in the eye.
And how about your own sense of your own personal responsibility? You have this personal history of examining how closely connected you are to this slave trading family. You make the point that, you know, whites in general have all reached a certain level in society where they are today, in part because of benefits that go back to the days of slavery. But how personal is it for you? How is it different that you're somehow directly connected to one of these families?
I do ask myself that question because I have a healthier version of guilt than I used to, but I can tell by how hard I work and how little I sleep and how I don't always take care of myself that there must be some guilt still in there that has me spending all my waking hours working on this stuff. And yeah, so I think there is a sense of responsibility that maybe goes deeper than just average citizen.
Is there anyone in your family who at any point in this process, Katrina said, can we just drop this?
None of us in the group, so they're, you know,
I wouldn't expect it to come from the people who've gone on the journey. I'm wondering if there are other people on the outside who said, you know, this is better left in some filing cabinet in Bristol. Let's not talk about this.
Yeah, there have been people, and they're not people who are denying that it happened or who question the horror of it all, but they do question the value of digging it up. And I think that stems from some fear that the way these things get talked about is in acrimonious, divisive, accusatory ways. And so there are people who feel like we will be the target of reparations lawsuits or anger that those people don't feel they deserve to have come in their way. And I can totally sympathize with that. I think it's a really...
Well, they're not entirely wrong. There is a constituency that says, yes, in fact, lawsuits is the way to settle this.
Right.
Right? I mean, and an academic constituency, not just people who are saying, I'm going to take you guys to court.
Right. And the other thing going on, I mean, the vast fortunes made in the DeWolf family from the slave trade were squandered a long time ago by second and third generation folks. So people, you know, are very quick to tell me that they don't have money from the slave trade. And so it's not going to be fair if people start coming after us. And then I say, well, but we've been pretty privileged since then, and you might not have slave trade money, but don't you have other inherited wealth? Oh, it's like an incredibly hard conversation to have to talk about that stuff and publicly about money and all that. So I share a defensiveness and a fear that other family members have, and yet I guess I just maintain the hope that it's better to put it out there and talk about it and see what we think as a country.
I get the impression listening to you, Katrina, that this is now your job.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that you were a student in seminary and trying to figure out what it was that you wanted to be, and that this little booklet from your grandmother arrived, and whether it was fate or coincidence or whatever, it's now what you do for a living, talking about your own family's responsibility and through that, whatever this country's responsibility is when it comes to talking about the after effects of slavery.
Yeah. I've been accused of having missionary zeal. It's true.
Are you comfortable with that? Are you feeling like there's a purpose to that?
I find it incredibly hard work to do and incredibly rewarding. So it's so meaningful, the types of conversations that I have with people, you know, white folks, African Americans. So it's deeply meaningful and feels hopeful, and it's incredibly hard work. So I do question the stamina required.
Because the difficult part of it, I suspect, is never going to go away. As long as you screen your film, you're going to have people stand up and take you on and say, you're wrong. I'm white, and it wasn't my fault.
Yeah.
and expect to somehow engage you in a debate on that.
Yeah. A lot will be directed at us, but I think it's part of our job to say, talk to each other. Like, we're hoping to catalyze the conversation, but if it just stays about us, that isn't ultimately what will serve.
So if you've spent as much time studying this, thinking about it, figuring out your own place in it, why do you say it's still hard?
Because even, you know, I think with Black Americans, I may feel like I've proven myself to some degree with the work I'm doing, but I've come to feel that I have to kind of prove myself over and over again because there's such a history that justifies their distrust of me. So I have to keep accepting that I have to face that distrust over and over again, and I have to keep not being intimidated by that or, you know, scared off by it or resentful of it because sometimes it's tempting. Do you know how hard I've been working? So,
are you a little stronger 10 years later or just a little more wounded?
Yeah, I am.
You are a little stronger.
Yeah.
Katrina Brown is the producer and director and writer of the film Traces of the Trade. It will air on the PBS series POV this summer. That book about the trip that I mentioned a little earlier is called Inheriting the Trade. It was written by Thomas Norman DeWolf. And you can find links to the film and the book on our website. And our website is thestory.org. One of the regular features of the story is something we call your story, a chance for you to tell me about a place or a person or a moment that occupies some spot of honor in your memory. Steve Lanier contacted me about a man who lived across the street from him when he was growing up in Tarboro, North Carolina. The man's full name was Louis Philip Hornthal, but everyone called him LP. Steve remembers him as a man who loved to laugh, who loved to play practical jokes, but Steve also remembers him as a man who combined that with both culture and compassion.
My image of LP has always been a guy with a smile, a wry smile on his face, in the summer, sitting out under a big oak tree with a gin and tonic in his hand.
What would he wear now?
It was always a pair of seersucker blue shorts.
Now, I gather one of the sort of hallmark stories of LP has to do with the fact that his wife, Mildred or Mid, had some difficulty getting up in the morning or some reluctance about getting up early in the morning.
There is indeed that story. It was a hot summer day. I would guess I was about 10 years old. And Mid had a doctor's appointment at 10 o'clock the next morning. And the notion of getting her up, calling her, and it being... It just wasn't a pleasant thought.
LP was trying to devise some way of getting
his wife up. He devised some way, and he was sitting out in his seersucker shorts with his gin and tonic, calling all the kids in the neighborhood over, and there were tons of kids.
Now, this is the day before, is it?
This is the evening before.
Okay.
And he said, "Kids, do you see that bush over there?" Which was a tree directly under their bedroom window. He said, "That tree is a magic candy tree, and it only blooms once a year, and tomorrow is the day. Now, it blooms at exactly 9 o'clock in the morning. If you come before 9 o'clock, the magic won't work. If you come after 9 o'clock, the birds will have eaten all the candy. So you have to come exactly at 9 o'clock." And you could just see that wry smile. Late at night, he went down to the shop, took a couple of boxes of candy, and meticulously tied the candy all over the tree. And the next morning at 9 o'clock, the kids were just sort of peeking around the corner, checking the time. And you can just imagine the screams and squeals of glee that
like a
it really is a magic candy tree. He's telling the truth.
But I bet Mid got up in time for her doctor's appointment.
And she was ready for her doctor's appointment. And the idea of going to that kind of effort to make other people laugh, to solve a problem, to turn what could have been a negative into something that you've laughed, that we've laughed about for literally decades.
I was going to say, and here we are, it's a story that's been passed down from generation to generation.
And continues. Now, just loved him.
Now, your own relationship with this man has a personal angle to it, because you saw him become quite close friends with your mother, again, using the same kind of humor. Is that right?
Yes, that is absolutely true.
Give me an example of the way that he'd interact with your mother.
When Mary, my very prim and proper aunt, would be visiting, the local newspaper, the Daily Southerner, would be delivered, and it was a small newspaper, always with a rubber band around it.
Right.
And so you'd go out into the yard, and the typical mode was to strip off the rubber band, throw it in the yard, and hopefully someday it would deteriorate and take the paper in. And Mary would be there, and LP would consistently come by, pick up a handful of the small rubber bands and walk in and say, "Evelyn, haven't I told you time and again not to leave your rubbers on the front yard?"
He made a joke out of his own death.
Well, he left instructions for how his funeral was to be handled. They did know he was to be cremated, and he wanted his remains to be deposited at the Episcopal Church in Plymouth. The area, he referred to that area as the burn center. Because he had emphysema, he said it was totally inappropriate for his remains to be put into one of these fancy urns, but instead it was much more appropriate that they be in a Prince Albert tobacco can.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. My guest is Steve Lanier. We're talking about a man he knew while growing up, a man nicknamed L.P. Steve says he had the best sense of humor he's ever come across. And as you just heard, when L.P. died, he left instructions that his cremated remains be put in a tobacco can. But the instructions didn't end there.
He defined the music that should be playing, and playing very loudly, thank you, including when the saints come marching in. and that it had to be top-shelf booze that was available, and this had to be a celebration of life. Later at the private service in Plymouth, people found little notes that LP had left in the bushes. It was just notes to people just saying goodbye. And
isn't that something?
But one of the best was he left his dining room table and chairs to his grandson, his namesake, and taped a note up under the table that was only found much later. And the note read, "Philip, you better improve your ways because it's hotter than hell down here." And I can just see LP just sort of giggling and laughing and just a great big smile.
I mean, the master of the practical joke that he was would not often see the results.
That's right.
Right? And so his joy was in setting it up.
It was the true lesson of deferred gratification.
Do you ever play pranks on people? Do you ever play jokes? Do you ever sort of borrow a page from LP's handbook?
I guess the page that I borrow is not the prank.
Right.
To say enjoy life, try to leave more than you take, and try to help people laugh. Both. It's fine to laugh at you or to help them laugh at their own foibles.
Or to be laughed at yourself.
Or to be laughed at. It's fine.
Steve, thanks for your portrait of LP. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's Steve Lanier with his story of LP. If you have one you'd like to share with me, send me a note, just a short email, a couple of lines. You can go to our website at thestory.org. That's the easiest way to find me. The Story is produced by Anita Woodley, Corey Princell, and Denise Schreiner. Jeanette Arrowood is our researcher. Much of our audio editing is done by Rachel McCarthy and Nick Vidinsky. Our engineer is Al Wadarski, with help from Peter Bombar. The managing editor of The Story is Carol Jackson. The senior producer is Greg Kelly. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.